scene in Kenosha. The wind chill is minus 19. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about a topic of deep personal interest to me, and I'm sure to many of you, and an issue which is, in a sense, growing in public intensity, and that is the whole matter of higher education and what it means to go to college, and if this is something that all people need to do or should do, or are there better ways to prepare young people for what the next stage of life will be. The book at hand is called Who Needs College Anymore? Imagining a Future Where Degrees Won't Matter. The author of the book is Kathleen Dulaski, a former ABC White House correspondent who has explored many facets of the whole matter of higher education and what it means for us collectively as a nation and what it means for the lives of individual people, those who are able to secure a college education and those who, for one reason or another, are not. She is, among other things, founder of the Education Design Lab, which has done a concerted effort to study many of the questions involving higher education. She is senior advisor for Harvard's Project on Workforce, and she is an adjunct professor at George Mason University. And in her new book, she has explored many facets of how we as a nation look at college, at the value of a college education, the way in which that public perception has changed quite drastically in recent years, and exploring some ways in which we might rethink the whole matter of the way colleges function, how we look at college and its experience, and the ways in which perhaps we can try to create other pathways, other avenues, for people to move from youth into adulthood, if you will. Kathleen Dulaski, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, and I should take you on my book tour. You're summing it up really well.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. In the interest of full disclosure, you should probably know something that all of our listeners already know, which is namely that my full-time job is as a college professor. I am an associate professor of music at a nearby liberal arts school, liberal arts four-year college, and so I have to confess that whenever I pick up a book that seems to be raising provocative possibilities of a brand new landscape, it kind of makes me, in a sense, relieved that I'm probably nearing retirement at the age of soon to be 65. But I mean, it, and on the other hand, how exciting to be thinking about the way in which colleges can dramatically, radically even rethink their sense of mission and purpose. I wonder if you could talk for a moment about the ways in which you have been drawn to this topic and the personal investment that you have in exploring this.
Well, thank you. That's a great place to start because, as you said at the beginning, I started out as a journalist and I did that for about 20 years in different in radio and TV, and then I was an early online journalist. And so it was a kind of a right turn or quite a shift for me to land in the education reform field, which has been the second half of my career. And I was in different types of roles, both in education finance. I was at Sallie Mae, who a lot of people know as the person they owe money to because they're the student lender. I then was working in the charter school environment, trying to help create new high-quality seats in urban districts around the country. I was on the board of a major public university and saw how hard it was for colleges to make these innovation shifts. And that's what led me to create, a little over 10 years ago, the Education Design Lab, and to try to build it into a national helpmate, really, for colleges who want to innovate from the inside to create new models that could support the broad range of people for whom the college model was not designed and was not working. And, you know, I don't think, I always sort of carry with me this percentage that, you know, 62%, I think it is, of Americans do not have a four-year degree. And yet, you know, you think about college as the ticket to the American dream. And so, well, what are the other 62% of people doing? And as, you know, as we hear the mantra that, you know, 70% of good jobs require a degree, what are they supposed to do? College wasn't designed for them. Some of them tried. 40% of people who try college, it doesn't work out. That's a huge percentage. And so these are the kinds of issues that drew me to start the lab and to work. We're now working with 100 plus colleges to create, for instance, shorter term pathways to jobs, not necessarily to degrees, but to job roles that can, you know, launch a career, a professional career, and not be dead end jobs. So that's what got me started on, you know, kind of the professional front. And then my own family, I had my children were struggling through the pressure cooker that expected them to go to college. That, you know, sort of steals me as an outsider when they, you know, this is 15 years ago, right before I started the lab. And they really kind of helped me see that this, even for people who have all the advantages of the middle class and good, you know, K-12 education, for many of them, it's not working. One of my kids ended up going to college. The other, you know, her grades were so bad that she, you know, had to go. She went to community college, which was a great bridge, and she did go to college eventually. But, you know, neither of them are in jobs now that needed a degree. And that's helped me see kind of the other side.
Hmm. The dedication of the book, I think, is important to acknowledge. You say this book is dedicated to new majority learners for whom college was never designed. I mean, it didn't take long as I probed into your book to understand that term, but that actually was a term with which I was not familiar until reading mm-hmm. your book. Although the concept behind the term is very, very familiar to anybody who is in higher education. Explain to our listeners what you mean by this new majority learner and the way in which college was never designed for somebody like that, at least in general.
Right. Well, thank you for noticing that, because I think it is really central to the statistic that I gave you, and the 62% of people who do not have degrees, and many of those who are getting degrees, but it's been such a struggle for them to get there because, you know, college isn't designed for them. I mean, if you look at it, it's basically anyone who wasn't in the sort of original charter that I'm putting in this bucket, and we use this term at the lab. They're new majority because at this point, when you look at who is going to college, mostly it's people who are a majority are people who are not didn't grow up in a family where people had been to college before. So they're a lot more first generation folks going to college, a lot of people of color, a lot of people who are, you know, over age of that 18 to 24-year-old, cohort that you think of going off in the family SUV to be dropped off their freshman year. That is not, you know, that is a minority. That white 18-year-old going to college is becoming a smaller and smaller minority of who's going to college. But yet the programs are still designed for them. the funding really supports you mainly if you're full-time or near full-time. So that's, you know, one of the things. And then the support systems, you know, everything from the job fairs to the tutoring offerings at colleges are set up for people who either live on campus or are available during the day, are in full-time classes, enroll, you know, once a year. And these are not the these don't meet the needs of the single mom, the veteran, the person who's doing college on the side while they're working full-time. That's the majority of learners today. And college wasn't designed for them. And strides are being made to, you know, make, let's say, the modalities more flexible. But the funding structures have not been updated to support people who need to do college in short bursts, for example. Mm. So I hope that answers the question.
It very, very much does. So one of the basic tenets of your book, and apparently this has been a focus of the Education Design Lab with which you've been working all these years, is this whole matter of colleges being wed to the notion of granting degrees, and that for a given college student, that's what so much of this is about, is attaining that degree and hanging that beautiful certificate on the wall, and versus the possibility of focusing more on skills and the acquiring of skills. At least in a nutshell, I mean, and of course that it can be unlocked to a greater degree by people exploring your book in detail, but explain in brief what you're talking about and in a sense what that would look like or the various ways that could look.
Right, so a study just came out this week that's getting some attention, which said that 8 out of 10 recent college grads say they learned more in 6 months on the job than in 4 years of college. And even more startling was what the employers in the survey said, which was 9 out of 10 of them said that they try to avoid hiring recent college grads because they're, you know, just not, you know, kind of ready to work or up for the job, or they don't have the skills that they need. And that's, you know, that's what we see on the ground when college grads are trying to get hired today, unless they're in very specific fields where the skills are known and named, and there are even possibly, you know, industry certifications that are required to get into the field for licenses, right? Those fields are going okay. But for everybody else, something like 50% of college graduates are not getting hired for jobs that needed a degree. And that is, you know, as that, you know, word gets out that that's what's happening, there's a lot of resentment. And that's why you see these surveys where, you know, the college degree is losing its, you know, its reputation. You know, people don't believe in the ROI. So your question is, well, what would it look like if it was done differently? I profile, you know, 5 types of schools, you know, colleges that are beginning to think about adding this idea of work experience, career-related work experience, right into the model. Ideally, you would be able to go in and out of college in what I describe as a stepladder approach, where you're coming in, you're gaining a first round of skills to build your earnings power so that you can then, you know, go into the market, and then you can either on the side or later, you know, come back and get the next installment. And, you know, by that point, you've got the experience to know, you know, which way do you want to take your career. So this idea that you could weave school and work together is really the basic thesis. And colleges are beginning to do it. Community colleges in particular, as you know, as a professor at a 4-year liberal arts college, it's harder for them to shift and to sort of unbundle, right, pieces of the, you know, the college product, if you will. But community colleges, you know, they were losing so much enrollment that they've really begun since COVID to design these shorter term pathways, where you come in for, you know, 6 months or even less to get ready for a particular job role that's needed in your region, and the roles have been designed with employers. And that's beginning to really take off. We've worked with 100 community colleges that are using this model. It's early days, but they're called micro pathways. So that's one, you know, one model that that is working, particularly at the community college level.
Right. I should mention that this radio station is owned by a very fine technical college, Gateway Technical College, and that's one of that's been such an illuminating experience for me to spend most of my workday in a traditional liberal arts environment, but to also be a part of this school that has engaged in a great deal of what you have been describing. And of course, in particular, because so often technical colleges have a student body that is widely variant beyond that 18 to 24 year old, and and they just have to be, and have managed to create, as you say, you know, various pathways and so on. I do appreciate the fact that more than once in your book, you acknowledge that some of this movement, as it occurs, or should it occur even more, does perhaps represent in some cases a loss, because there has been, and maybe ideally always should be, something to the college experience beyond prepping you for your job. I mean, not to minimize the importance of that, but there are other things there are other things that are gained, important things, that and many of them that cannot be quantified, and maybe not even fully understood and appreciated even by the student themselves, but that are valuable. And I do appreciate that in your book you are honest about that, and I think hope that some of these changes that are made will not be at the cost of losing that altogether.
Well, I thought a lot about this particular issue because, I was an English poli-sci major, right? So I was the liberal arts piece of my four-year experience was absolutely transformative for me. And the idea that we are all going to move to a just-in-time learning model where we come in for skills, but technical skills in effect, and then go off to a workplace, it's kind of, I mean, it's downright scary to me that we won't have communities where we kind of learn to get along, where we study things like civic engagement, and we, you know, engage in civic, our small cohorts. That worries me. I ask 4-year colleges to think about how to offer the model, because the way they defend the model currently is to say, well, you have to come to a 4-year college because there's so much more than learning skills. Great. But for increasingly, people don't want to spend the time and tuition to get that. Like, it sounds valuable, but not valuable enough. Like, how can you offer that in smaller chunks, or how can you offer it as, you know, sort of alongside the technical skills in ways that they could engage it? You know, it's like when you go on Amazon and you can do a one-time purchase, or you can sign up for the subscription model. How can you package it differently so that it's not unaffordable for more and more people, and that they see the value of it independently from, learning to be an accountant or a nurse?
You said something earlier, and I certainly know exactly what you're talking about, when you said that one of the things you saw in sitting on the Board of Regents of a college or university, that you saw how difficult it is for institutions of higher learning to radically or dramatically reshape themselves. And I suppose that's maybe just kind of the nature of the beast, and also one doesn't want to dramatically reshape oneself in a way that ultimately ends up being completely counterproductive or short-sighted or whatever, but it is not easy to make dramatic changes. What is your advice for a given institution that feels like they must remake themselves, repackage what they offer, whatever? What is your advice in terms of managing to accomplish that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I always say to what I call intrapreneurs, meaning people who are entrepreneurs inside their institution, to find a willing sandbox, because usually there's a department or a part of a college that has more flexibility if they're not they're not under the degree requirements, or the faculty senate isn't paying as much attention to them, right? Because there are a lot of restrictions within higher ed, for sure. And to experiment in a way that begins to show success in enrollment, because all of the colleges are worried about what they're calling the enrollment cliff, which starts this year. And that's just a fact that there are going to be a lot fewer 18-year-olds coming of age. And everyone's very worried about that, and fear is a great motivator. So for them to stay solvent, particularly smaller, non-elite university colleges, they have to innovate. And they're starting to do that, but I always recommend, find the area where you could, dramatically expand your experiential learning, offering, and then demonstrate to the stalwarts or the deniers, if you will, that you're making strides here, and that this is, quote, saving enrollment. I mean, that's the way that, for instance, Southern New Hampshire University became the largest university in the country, or I guess they are the largest single university in the country at this point. And they used this strategy. Hmm.
You point out that some of this new urgency springs around not just this so-called demographic cliff, this drastic falling off in the number of young people who would potentially, we would think of as the standard college student, that number is plunging. And mm-hmm. that means, you don't even have to be a mathematician to understand the math of that, how that makes this a very difficult scenario. You also point to, in recent years, first of all, in the wake of the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor incidents, we are in the midst of a national kind of racial reckoning, and looking at systemic racism with new eyes and maybe heightened awareness. You also point out that the COVID pandemic showed mm-hmm. us actually how fragile our economy is, and the way in which our economy suffers when certain things, in a sense, vanish or are upended. And you say that really showed us the need for a fully dynamic sector-by-sector skills map. And you see this reshaping of higher education as being part of that. Explain what this sector-by-sector skills map is all about and how we would all be served by that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, thank you for asking about that. The sector-by-sector skills map is this idea that in any field, you could, as a learner or as a college trying to figure out what to teach, right, you would know what the skills progression needed to be. Let's say in cybersecurity, which is the example I give where the best version of this map does exist, and it was created because at the governmental level, the federal governmental level, because we were suffering from such shortages of talent in the field progressions. There's still 500,000 cybersecurity unfilled jobs, so this is a field that came together where the employers came together and said, okay, we need to name the skills so people know what to learn, and the hiring will go more smoothly. And the promotion, people will know how to get from one role to the next and how much money they can make. It has to be visible. And I use the analogy of a GPS, like your Google Maps GPS that you'd have in the car, where, you know, you put in a an address, and you then Google Maps takes you there. We can and should get to a point where you could say, okay, I don't even know the name of the place I want to go, because the cybersecurity jobs, for example, or the AI jobs, I don't even know what they're called. I don't know how to set myself up for that. But let me put what I do know in the map and see where it suggests I go, and it suggests what training I need. And as I get those skills, because I also describe in the book what's becoming known as your skills wallet, right, which would be your digital repository, personal, of your skills, and you can make those visible to employers, you know, through your GPS in this coming world. We're not there yet. And then they, you know, employers would be able to find you. That's the vision of both the skills wallet and this GPS skills map. But we don't have the data sets. You know, people say, oh, AI will answer the question for you. We don't have the data sets for AI to use to tell you what to do and where to go in many of these fields. A, because a lot of them are new, and B, because employers aren't getting together and, you know, sort of universalizing the names of the job roles, the names of the skills, and we just don't have the information yet in most fields. But we will get there, and that will be exciting. A very positive use of AI at that point.
I appreciate the fact that you say at one point, I subscribe to both the fix-it and disrupt-it mm-hmm. camps of social change as you approach this topic and as you have written this book. Who needs college anymore? Imagining a future where degrees won't matter. Published by Harvard Education Press. The author, Kathleen Dulaski. Kathleen Dulaski, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for giving the world this important and thought-provoking book.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going to the Morning Show archives for an interview that was initially recorded and initially broadcast way back in 2003. We're going to be speaking on the Morning Show today with Jeffrey Makoff, who is the co-author, along with Rhoda Makoff, of a very interesting book and potentially life-changing book called Get Off the Fence: 10 and 1 Steps to Help You Make That Big Decision. All of us at one point or another in our lives will be confronted by a big decision, a very important choice which we might have to make. And most of us confront those not fully equipped to deal with them. And this book just might make a very, very positive difference for you. We have with us on the phone Jeffrey Makoff, who actually is an attorney and co-chair and CEO of Digital Custom Group Incorporated. He and his wife, Rhoda Makoff, have really helped a lot of people, consulted with them to help confront some of the big decisions which confront them. And we talk with Jeffrey Makoff for a few minutes now about his book. Jeffrey Makoff, we welcome you to
Thank
the
you.
Morning
nice
show.
To be here.
First of all, do you pull from your own personal life or personal history very much in the writing of this book?
No, not really. Certainly the book is based upon the experience that I have and the experience that my co-author has, but the book is not about us. It's not a biography or an autobiography. It's a book that gives advice on how to make big decisions.
One of the things which is very interesting to me is the step one of your 10 and 1 steps that you suggest for people. And that is that you really have to sort out exactly what it is that you need to decide. You say, make the real decision and dump the decoys. What sort of decoys might confuse the issue for a given person?
Well, there are as many decoys as there are people. The theory of the decoy and the practice of the decoy is that we gravitate toward decisions that are comfortable, but not always the decision that moves us forward. Therefore, a typical decoy might be someone who deliberates for a year or two whether they should break up with someone when there's really no relationship left there, but they don't want to take that final step to have that conversation and break up the relationship, and so they deliberate endlessly about whether they should break up, when the real issue in that kind of situation is often, how do I break up?
Mm. Yeah, you say decoys start out innocently as a way for us to avoid or cope with pain. It's really a sidestepping mechanism.
It's a way of making a decision and temporarily feeling like we're taking a step in the right direction or working on it, when in fact we often are avoiding the real decision altogether because it's too big for us to grasp.
Hmm. You encourage someone in trying to sort through this to really confront those decoys with what you call active skepticism. Explain what you think active skepticism is.
Well, active skepticism applies especially well when a decoy decision is being foisted on you by another person. Quite often in business and in personal life, someone will come up to you and say, you have two choices. You can do A or you can do B. Well, it's important to be skeptical when other people are defining your choices, because there may be a third choice or a fourth choice, but that choice doesn't serve the interests of the person who's presenting them to you. Classic example is when a parent says, either you live with my drinking problem or you move out of the house because this is my house. Well, that looks very black and white, and the parent who has the problem would like the child to think that those are the only two choices, but there's a third choice. The child can take steps to intervene and try to stop that drinking problem.
Hmm. But that might be a choice that they shy away from.
It very well might be. It's a difficult step, and it's a big step, but it's critical when making the decision how to manage, for example, a parent with a drinking problem, that you understand all of your choices and not just focus on the choices that, in this case, the victim or the person who has the substance abuse problem is giving you.
Hmm. You state in this chapter a quote by Charles Kettering, which says, a problem well stated is a problem half solved. That really, in a nutshell, talks about kind of the essential heart of this, that the identification of a problem, it might sound simplistic, but it really is absolutely essential to arriving eventually at a proper and helpful choice or decision.
Well, it's critical, because making decisions that aren't going to solve the problem or aren't going to move you forward won't get you anywhere, except temporarily maybe make you think that you're making progress. But what you're really doing there is you're avoiding the change that's going to move your life ahead. And that's not where you want to be in the long term.
We should mention at this point that one of the choices that you make, you and your co-author, in writing this book, is that you discuss each step, and then at the end of each chapter is a real-life story in which that particular facet of all this is played out. Tell us about the decision which you made to approach all of this from in this particular way.
Well, the big decision we made when we wrote this book was to communicate with a consumer audience. It would have been easy for us to put together a highly technical book on decision theory that was meant for lawyers and academic people to read, but that's not what we wanted to do. We wanted to take our experience and put it in a context that a lot of people would enjoy reading and that they would find interesting and fascinating. And we looked around at what people like, how they like to be communicated to, and we found that lately, especially with books like Chicken Soup for the Soul and similar books, people really want to read stories about other people, and they want to get inside the heads of other people and understand what happened in situations that people faced more or less like what they faced.
For instance, the real-life story which ends Chapter 1 is with someone named Catherine Conley, whose father has suffered a massive stroke, and she is confronted with enormous decisions about how he should be cared for. And it's interesting because, of course, I might not face that particular choice in my life. I hope I don't. But I will face other enormous choices or challenges. And you think Catherine Conley's story is going to somehow be helpful or applicable to me?
Oh, there's much, especially in that particular story, that people can gain. First of all, most people will have life support decisions to make in their lifetime. We have the graying of the baby boom generation, and the number of people who are in their 30s and 40s who are going to be making decisions about life support for parents over the next 20 years is truly awesome. A lot of people are going to be faced with the decision. But other lessons that can be learned from this story have to do with your own life support decisions. What should you be doing now to make sure that if you have, in the case of Catherine Conway, a 24-year-old daughter or son who has to make a decision for you, are you giving them proper guidance? What can you do? What small steps can you take so that the decision that your own child has to make is not so painful?
Well, once we have figured out what the big decision really is that we might be wanting to avoid, it's interesting in Chapter 2, which or Step 2, you say then that we have to take that big challenge or big problem and we have to break it up into small pieces. So,
Go ahead.
So at the first, you're telling us, you know, don't avoid those big problems. But then, of course, one way we can actually deal with them effectively is to not leave them as big problems, but to break them into components that we can kind of digest and handle maybe more effectively.
Exactly. This is a common misconception that skilled decision makers are very good at dealing with big, complex issues. And what you learn when you work with people who are very skilled at making tough decisions is that they're no better than anybody else at complex issues. What they're good at is taking a complex issue and making it into a bunch of simple issues and then resolving them. And this is a skill that lawyers and doctors have to master. Someone sits in front of you in the office and relates this story that's all over the place. First meetings are always like this. The story's all over the place. And the lawyers and the doctors say, okay, this is what I'm hearing. These are the core issues. I'm going to address one. I'm going to address two. I'm going to address three. And the rest of it, I'm going to disregard.
Hmm. You talk about let's write things down, first of all. Let's try to sort this out. And you think it's important that we think about wants and concerns and practical factors, that separation can really be helpful.
Yeah, this is a comment on the historical way that people think that decisions are made, and that's with a list of pros and cons. I have to say, I've never made a decision with a list of pros and cons. I've seen very few people who can successfully make a decision that way. I think it's not clear what the list of pros and cons adds. So what we say is don't think of it in terms of pros and cons. Think of it in terms of what you want to get out of the decision, what your concerns are about the decision, and what the practical limitations are. And each of those has a meaning, and we talk about that.
Hmm. In Chapter 3, we kind of start talking about ignorance or the unknown, let's say. You say that it's important that we identify the most important target questions and come to grips with the fact that we might at that moment not know the answers to some of the really important questions.
This happens all the time. People make decisions that are driven by information, and yet the decision you're making is going to be based on information that you have to gather a lot of the time. If you don't admit that you don't know something and therefore need to gather more information, you're going to be making a decision either without information or with incorrect information that somehow has gotten to you. So we tell people, step back when you have a big decision to make and be realistic about what you know and what you need to investigate. And then we spend some time talking about how to get good information.
Well, right, and not just that, but to discard assumptions that you might be making that are not, in fact, valid.
People make many assumptions in day-to-day life. We could not get along in day-to-day life with any efficiency if we didn't make a huge number of assumptions. So we're good at making assumptions. But when we're making a big decision, we need to put that aside and say, okay, what's really going on here? And find that out. What is the real fact, not what I'm speculating about?
Right. As we gather information in Step 4, you give us, first of all, some really wonderful criteria. We don't have time to really go into them very much, but you pose the question, how do you know what information is reliable? And, you know, even if we're not confronting a big life-changing decision, it's still important. I mean, even if you're just writing a term paper for school, it's important that we be equipped with a criteria for determining, is this information that I have come across legitimate, reliable, or not?
We spend a lot of time on that. You know, we're in an information society, so we've got a huge amount of text available to us on any subject. But some of that is reliable and some is unreliable. Because there's so much of it, we all have to become better at assessing bias, at looking at sources. When we see an opinion, is this a junk opinion or is this an opinion from someone who's really qualified to give me information that I'm going to use, possibly to alter the course of my life?
And I'm so glad you mentioned the word bias, because at one point in this chapter you talk about caring bias, that we have to be on guard for the caring biases of our parents or friends and relatives. Explain what you mean by that.
People use bias a lot almost like a bad word. It really means something about the source of information that would cause the information possibly to be tainted. And so we think of bias as obviously someone is trying to sell us something, so therefore they may taint the information to make the product look good. But it's critical to recognize that bias also applies to people who want to do good for you. Parents are extremely biased advisors. Close friends are so biased that many people don't really rely on them at all when they make a decision, because the friends are often just trying to be supportive. So when you go to a friend and you give your friend a great business idea, the friend just nods and says, oh, that's fantastic, yes, you should pursue this. There's a real question whether you should leave your job based upon that advice, because your friend may say yes to just about anything you put out there.
Right. In chapter five, or step five, you are encouraging us to figure out the odds, reduce the uncertainties. I mean, really, once we've sorted out what the reliable information is. You also say, we need, at least to some extent, to ditch the anecdotes. You think we rely on anecdotes a little too much and don't realize how unstable they can be as a means towards a decision.
Anecdotes are all over the place in our society. It's become the principal form of entertainment for people. To see snippet stories about how this celebrity succeeded or how this business person made $100 million, and we're bombarded with these, and they're very interesting, and we absorb them. But the question then becomes, how does this anecdote about another person who made a decision, for example, to start a business, affect my decision whether to start a business? And the big piece of advice that we give here is don't sit around trying to find the similarities between you and this superstar of entrepreneurialism. Take a good hard look at the differences and see if this person had an advantage that you didn't have or that you don't have.
In step six, You talk about a very commonly held myth that the best decisions are made without emotion, that someone is doing themselves a favor if they discard their emotions at the point that they are trying to make a powerful emotion. You say that is not good advice at all.
Certainly when it comes to big decisions, and I would put aside decisions related to property because they are in a separate category where you should be pretty emotional, but other big decisions, by and large, are emotion-driven. And if you try to shut your emotions out and make a marriage decision or an education decision or a career decision based upon what looks good in paper, the decision is probably going to fail. And it's going to fail because if you're going to carry out those decisions, you need to have emotional staying power. You need to have commitment. So doing something that looks good on paper when you lack that commitment is only going to be a temporary decision, because you may find yourself 3 or 4 months down the line without steam to go forward emotionally or in terms of the passion you bring to it to do it right.
You mentioned in step seven the fact that sometimes we're talking about hard choices and sometimes short-term pain that we have to be willing to tolerate for the sake of a long-term goal.
You know, if you look at people who have made successful life decisions, the one fact that they all have in common is that they all have an ability to suffer pain today, financial cost, some kind of risk, emotional cost, to have that difficult conversation for the sake of making tomorrow a better day. And one of the questions I always ask people when I meet them is, do you tend to spend less than you could spend of the money that you make? And people who have achieved financial success almost always say yes. I always live slightly below my means or somewhat below my means. People who have financial trouble often say the opposite. They're living above their means. Now, what does living below your means mean? It means being able to say no at the store for the sake of building up that pile of savings that eventually will let you make those big moves without as much fear.
Hmm. Oddly enough, in step eight, you'd say that it maybe makes sense to be a brilliant procrastinator. And you're actually bringing to the table another misconception about decision-making, that good decision-making is done rapidly, right on the spot. You're saying that's really actually not the case.
There's a lot of worry out there about procrastination. It drives people crazy to believe that they can't make decisions fast enough. But when you look at people who've made great decisions, most of them are the world's craftiest procrastinators. They will only make the part of the decision that they have to make and that they're comfortable with. They will defer without even showing that they're deferring large parts of the decision, and they'll get out of decisions entirely that they don't want to make. And what I would recommend is that people spend less time worrying about their procrastination and more time figuring out what it is that they need to make the decision that is causing them not to make the decision. Sometimes it's a piece of information. Sometimes they're emotionally not ready. Sometimes they're financially not ready. The number of people who truly can't make up their mind and are, you know, real procrastinators is very small in my experience.
So we shouldn't sort of misdiagnose ourselves as procrastinators. We might not be, actually.
I would ask myself the question, if I'm having trouble making this decision, and this has gone on for a year or two, what is the problem? What am I missing? Am I not feeling comfortable with the information I have? Am I not emotionally ready? Or am I just afraid to say no? I think the decision's going to be no. I've got a person out there who I'd have to tell that. I don't want to hurt their feelings, and so I'm putting it off because I don't want to have that conversation.
You give us great advice on keeping the risk of failure in proper perspective, to not let that sort of loom over us and paralyze us. And you also say in step 10 that we should make a preliminary decision, but also maybe craft a really great plan B. Why is that helpful?
It's important to have backup plans and also to take steps before you make your decision to minimize the risk. Every good decision is going to have some risk. Yet, you don't necessarily have to accept those risks. You can sometimes work with them. And a simple example is, let's say I'm going to make a decision to do a substance abuse intervention, and I'm concerned that word is going to get around the family and other family members who are more distant criticize me for taking some strong action against a relative substance abuse. Well, one way to minimize the risk that I'm going to suffer that criticism may be to have a conversation in advance or contemporaneously with the intervention with more remote family members and give them a heads up and let them know what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, if that can be done still consistent with the privacy of the person who I'm intervening against. Hmm.
Interestingly, in your plus one step, you talk about the gut, the instinct. In fact, I think at one point in that chapter, you talk about how instinct can be like an angel, and that for all the important, hard and fast components of a decision that we need to reflect upon and consider carefully, that we should also not discard just gut instincts, that can also be a great aid in all of this.
When we use the term gut instinct, we're referring to what's more commonly known as intuition. Intuition is how a fact gets into our conscious mind other than through our rational faculty. That's why when we have intuitions, they seem to pop up. Study an issue, and everything says go right, and you say to yourself, no, I don't feel comfortable with right. I need to go left. That's an intuition, and it's hard even to explain where they come from because they don't come through our normal rational analytical process. They come from somewhere else, and we use our rational process to do our explaining. And that's why people say, I don't know why I feel this way, but I do. It's critical to understand your intuition, to pursue it, not to shut it out, because it could be the product of some analysis you've been doing with parts of your mind that are simply not the parts that you're focused on. Hmm.
Well, the book is a really thought-provoking one and potentially so helpful for anyone, and that means everyone, who is going to be confronting big decisions in their lives. The book is called Get Off the Fence, 10 Plus 1 Steps to Help You Make That Big Decision, written by our morning show guest today, Jeffrey Makoff, along with Rhoda Makoff. The book is published by Health Communications Incorporated of Deerfield Beach, Florida.
And again, that interview was recorded back in 2003. Tomorrow, former FBI agent Mike German and his hard-hitting book called Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. Our weather forecast is for sunny skies but bitterly cold temperatures today. Our high temperature, 7 above. Our wind chills as low as 20 below zero. Partly cloudy overnight, bitterly cold, 9 below the overnight low, and wind chills close to 30 below zero at certain times. Continued very cold tomorrow with a high of 8 above and serious wind chills tomorrow. Wednesday, not quite so cold. Under cloudy skies, Wednesday's high 12.